Logically, she knows that most human beings can pick up a manual and learn about transmissions and carburetors, but to Ellen they sound like the names of foreign countries in which she would be terribly, hopelessly lost. As Holly's field fades behind them, the blue shine of the lake stretches far and flat to their right. There are no islands, only water that lifts to meet the horizon, the precise seam concealed by mist. She stares out across the rich lake farms, the edges of the fields still trimmed with snow. Ring-billed gulls litter the darkest soil for warmth, heads pointed north toward the farm where James grew up. The barn burned mysteriously 5 years ago, and the old stone house stands alone beside the deep, blackened hole, without even a shade tree for comfort. As they pass by, a red-tailed hawk lifts away from a weathered fence post, its shadow floating over the highway. "How beautiful," Ellen says. But Barb hasn't seen it. Ellen glances back at the kids. They are both lost in the music booming from the speakers behind their ears, something with a steady, driving beat. James's departure seems like a dream, and she relaxes deeper into her seat, enjoying the way Barb controls the car, speeding up at just the right moments as they fly through the curves by the old grain mill. "So, did James take off again today?" Barb says.
"Yes."
Barb turns down the music. "Well?"
"Well, what?"
"Well, doesn't it stink, him leaving you stuck with his parents like that?"
"I guess I've gotten used to it," Ellen says, surprised.
"No, you haven't," Barb says. "No one gets used to anything. They just get numb. That's what's happened to you. You let him get away with anything he wants, him and his parents, too."
Ellen sees a white flash of rage.
"What?" "Now look," Barb says. "We're friends, right? So I'm trying to help you stick up for yourself. Just because you married James doesn't give him the freedom to run your whole life."
"Not in front of my children," Ellen says, hating Barb fiercely.
"Oh, come on," Barb says. "Kids know these things before the rest of us do." "No, we don't," says Amy.
"I take my marriage vows seriously, even if some people don't," Ellen says.
It slips out before she can stop herself. Barb pulls over to the side of the road. Ellen wishes helplessly for another car to pass by, a deer to stray into the field, a dog to trot over from a nearby farm, anything to distract Barb, who wears the same look of fierce concentration she gets whenever she zeroes in on a child's problem at school. Her teeth are sunk into her lower lip. Her eyes are glittering, snake eyes. In another moment, she will unhinge her jaws, swallow Ellen whole, crush her shell against her ribs, and digest whatever secrets spill out.
"This isn't the Dark Ages," Barb says. "Women have choices. I don't care what a priest will tell you. You shouldn't have to stay with a man who's hurting you."
"This is none of your business," Ellen says. "Maybe you better just take me home."
"I look at you and I see myself. You think it's going to get better somehow, but it won't, baby. It just won't."
"Stop it!"
"Sometimes marriages don't work out."
"Take me home," Ellen says.
"Sure," Barb says. "Fine. Hide your head in the ground."
She pulls the keys out of the ignition, tosses them into Ellen's lap. "But you're going to drive."
"I can't drive a car like this."
"What do you mean, a car like this?"
"With gears."
"You mean you can't drive stick?"
Ellen glares at her.
Barb says, "Well, you're going to learn. When was the last time you did anything new, for Christ's sake?"
She gets out of the car, walks around to Ellen's side. When Ellen doesn't move, she opens the door, pulls her out by the arm. The keys fall into the road, and Ellen starts to hiccup.
"Hold your breath," Barb suggests,
but Ellen can't stop. The hiccups are shrill, painful. She bends over, hands on her hips, trying to catch her breath.
"I'll crash," she says, her shoulders jerking. "I'll end up killing us all."
"You wanted to kill me a second ago, didn't you?"
"I still do."
"Drive," Barb says, and she picks up the keys, presses them into Ellen's hand. They stall out twice before Ellen gets the Camaro into gear.
"Push forward to find first," Barb says, but the gear shift sneaks to the left and Ellen, still hiccuping, throws them into reverse. The Camaro scoots backward into the ditch, stalls again.
"I can't do this," Ellen says.
The kids are holding each other's hands.
"Don't flood it," Barb says. "Go easy now."
And Ellen starts it up again, kicks up dust, then lurches under the road.
"Use your clutch. Shift. Shift."
Barb says, and they almost stall, but then they don't. Ellen peeks at the speedometer. They're steady at 30 miles an hour. She keeps both hands on the wheel. She hiccups, checking the rearview mirror, but there are no other cars in sight.
I thought you wanted to go home, Barb says after a while.
I do.
But you're going the wrong way.
I know that. I don't want to have to turn around.
You could turn around in a driveway somewhere.
No, there's not enough room.
Barb turns up the radio again, settles back. What are you going to do, then?
I'm going to turn around in the parking lot at the beach where I won't hit anything. Turn that noise off so I can think.
Do you think I'd let you drive my car if I thought you were going to wreck it?
You turn down the music, Barb says, but Ellen doesn't want to take her hands from the wheel. She hiccups three times in rapid succession. She's read in the Guinness Book of World Records about a man who hiccuped for 17 years straight before he died, and she wonders if this is how something like that starts.
Barb turns to the kids and says, Your old ma's a pretty good driver, huh?
Ellen checks the mirror again and sees the children look at each other as if they think both she and Barb are crazy. 5 miles and 15 minutes later, Ellen coasts into the beach parking lot and the Camaro stalls again. Before she can start it up, Barb has the keys. She says, Say, kiddos, why don't you play on the beach while your mom and me have a chat? They leave the car like sparks darting away from a fire. Amy yanks up Bert's hood before they walk down to the ice along the edge of the water. There they stand, shoulders touching, two small, dark figures on a wide gray surface. I'm sorry about what I said before, Ellen says to Barb.
Hey, my hiccup stopped.
And she starts to cry. Barb passes her a tissue, another. She strokes her hair. She finds a linty roll of lifesavers in the bottom of her purse and tries to get Ellen to take one. She offers Ellen blush, rouge, cherry-flavored chapstick, green eyeshadow, the blunt cap of an acorn, a pen. Ellen cries and cries.
I just wanted you to talk to me, Barb keeps saying. I just wanted you to know that you're not all alone.
That night, Amy takes Ellen by the hand and pulls her into the bedroom. Herbert is already in bed, his thumb wedged into his mouth. Ellen expects to be bombarded with questions. Why did Barb say those things about Daddy? Why were you crying in the car? But Amy closes the door behind them and puts her finger to her lips. Shh, she says. Look what she gave me. She lifts her pillow, and there is Mary Margaret's piano-shaped bottle that used to stand beside the empty ballerina on the top bathroom shelf, the bottle Amy has always loved. She gave you this? Ellen says. Can I hold it again? Herbert says. Amy picks it up and turns it over and over in her hands before handing it carefully to Herbert. Ellen listens to the musical flow of the perfume inside it. She said she didn't mean to hurt me, Amy says. She said I could have bled to death and then it would be her fault. She said I could have died, Amy says, and her eyes are huge. No one dies from a little cut, honey. Your grandma was just upset.
I know that, Amy says.
It was really, really weird. Herbert returns it and she tucks it back under her pillow. You know, she says, I don't even want it now. I'm too old for it. I don't know what to do with it. Besides, she doesn't even like me.
She doesn't look at Ellen.
Ellen feels her tense, as though she expects to be contradicted.
But you're going to keep it, Ellen says.
Yes, Amy says seriously. I have decided to keep it. The Way of the Cross. At night, when her hunger becomes tangible, thick and cold as iron in her gut, Salome dreams of a small house filled with many small doors. It is a cozy house strewn with hand-braided rugs. A fire burns in the fireplace. Family pictures line the walls, and the solemn faces look familiar, although Salome can't place where she's seen them before. On the floor, two children, twin boys, play naked with their toes. Salome picks them up and walks from room to room, a baby clutched beneath each arm, calling out, "Is there anyone here?" She doesn't quite hear the sound of something pattering behind her. When she turns to look, it's too late. A wolf, yellow-eyed and icy-toothed, leaps out at her with the silence of a cloud, and in that silence Salome begins to run, scattering rugs and crashing into furniture, the babies banging her hips. She dashes through door after door until she reaches the last one, which is locked. Then she falls on the babies and devours them herself. The wolf disappears. Salome swallows, blinks her yellow eyes. She awakens with a taste of blood in her mouth. She has bitten her lip again, the chapped flesh split pink. As she sits up, the odor of her body wafts from beneath the quilts. On New Year's Day, she caught a bad cold, and for months it has lingered in her chest and throat, the long ache of fever nesting in her limbs. Now, after walking to Mass in the morning, it is too much of an effort to bathe, to shop, to go to the laundromat, to clean the gritty plates piled up in the sink. She turns on the light, and shadows scatter across the walls of her tiny apartment, slip away into the darkness through the single window overlooking the water treatment plant. There is no place lonelier than the night, even with the Lord keeping watch, even with his gift of dreams and the promise of his reward. She watches a mouse dart along the windowsill, dark eyes bulging velvet. She sings to it softly an old lullaby of Mama's. Braun Kuh, schwarze Kuh, mach die Augen zu. When Salome was 12, she awoke in the night and knew something was very wrong. She lay perfectly still in the cold, dark room, feeling the warmth of Mary Margaret's small body beside her own, listening to the ragged snores of her brothers in the room across the hall. Slowly, she moved her hand across her neck and shoulders, over her chest, and down toward the hot, aching core of her belly. She rolled on her side, and her thighs stuck together. The sheets were moist, and she recognized the smell of slaughter and sickness, of birth and death. She sat up, shivering as the air licked the tops of her arms, and she lit the candles on the nightstand. Shadows opened their eyes on the walls and stretched their long, dark limbs. The shadow of the rocker by the window was a man. The shadow from the lip of the water pitcher was the sickle that he carried, and Salome believed death had come for her. When she pulled the rosary from beneath her pillow, she saw the white sleeve of her nightgown was stained with blood. The blood was the color of pine pitch, and it was everywhere, streaked on her thighs and hips, the sheets, her gown. Mary Margaret stirred sleepily and opened her eyes. When she saw Salome, she sat up too. Her shadow on the wall wavered beside the man who stopped and let his sickle fall to his side. "Get Ma," Salome whispered, afraid to move. Mary Margaret looked at Salome's bloody lap and leaped out of the bed with a shriek. Her breath left a white twist hanging in the air. When she saw blood on her own gown, she screamed again, louder, dancing up and down on her small bare feet. The motion of her shadow consumed the ghost upon the wall, abandoning Salome and her shame to the world of living people, of fathers and mothers, brothers and sisters, where no one ever forgets. It was the boys who came into the bedroom first. They clogged the doorway with their tousled heads and wide-awake staring eyes. Mary Margaret was sobbing, wiping at her gown with a washstand towel. "We should tell Ma," one of the boys said. But Mama was already there, pushing them aside. Salome bent her head, waiting for Mama's sharp slap, for she knew by this time where the blood was coming from. But instead of hitting her, Mama poked her fingers into Salome's back and belly. "Hurts here?" she said briskly. Her nightgown was sprinkled with small yellow flowers, each like an eye, harsh and accusing. Salome nodded. "Anywhere else?" When Salome shook her head, Mama leaped at the boys. "Out!" she told them. The boys slunk into the hallway, averting their eyes, for the voice Mama used was a familiar one. It was the voice that answered the indecent questions of the younger ones and scolded the impure thoughts that were written on the faces of the oldest. It was the voice that said, "You don't look at your sister that way, and you come away from that wash line, and you throw them drawings in the trash barrel." The boys crept away to their beds without speaking, and soon Salome stood numbly clean, lost in a fresh white gown that belonged to Mama. Between her legs, thrusting forward like a pouch beneath her belly, was the cloth bundle Mama had given her. The bleeding would come back every month, God's curse upon all women since the time of sinful Eve. Mary Margaret sat quietly in the rocking chair, still flushed from crying, dressed in a gown of cherry-colored wool that had belonged to Salome when she was just an innocent girl, not a grown woman like she was now. "Wash your cloths in cold water," Mama said as she finished making up the bed with fresh linens. "Let them soak in the covered bucket behind the back house."
"Yes, Ma."
"Don't talk about this to nobody. When you get like this, stay away from the boys."
"Yes, Ma."
"Mary May, I hope you're listening. This'll happen to you someday, though I hope you'll be older than your sister here."
"It will never happen to me," Mary Margaret said fiercely. "Do I still have to sleep next to her?"
"Silly little cricket," Mama said, and she kissed Mary Margaret affectionately. "Go to sleep quick, and the angels will bring you good dreams."
She scooped Mary Margaret up and plunked her into the bed, drawing the quilts up over her nose.
"You too," she said to Salome. And Salome lay down awkwardly, feeling the cloth bundle shift between her legs. She hesitated, then felt with her hand to make sure it was still in place. She did not know if it was wrong to touch herself that way or not. Mama pinched her cheek and blew out the candles.
"Try not to think about it," she said.
As soon as she was gone, Mary Margaret rolled as far away from Salome as she could get. Sometimes at night, as they were falling asleep, Mary Margaret played a game of make-believe, waving her small ringed finger in the air as if it were a magic wand, and everything she said would come true.
"Someday I'm going to live in my own house, on the lake, with a porch made out of stone. Guess how many horses I'll have?"
Then Salome had to guess, and she always guessed wrong, because Mary Margaret changed her mind each time they played.
"Every day I will choose a different horse to ride, and some will be yellow, and some will be green, and some will be purple, and some will be blue. In the afternoon I will practice on my own piano so big that I'll keep it in a special room. I'll travel all over the world and give concerts until I'm famous and rich. Guess how many dresses I'll have?"
And she would describe each of the dresses, one by one, using the beautiful words Mama taught her. Magenta, alabaster, incarnadine, weaving them with her voice until Salome could see them hanging on the hangers, made of ivory, the smallness of Mary Margaret's hands and waist, the lace twisted through Mary Margaret's hair. And Salome would forget it was a sin to think that way, to be filled with pride and vanity. And she'd secretly imagined such dresses for herself, though she never said so aloud because she knew she was too plump and plain to wear such beautiful things. But this night, Mary Margaret said nothing. Salome thought she had fallen asleep when suddenly Mary Margaret said,
"When I'm grown up, I'm not going to bleed and stink up the bed with my smell."
Salome closed her eyes, feeling the weight of the darkness on her eyelids.
"Nothing like this is ever going to happen to me," Mary Margaret said. "I'm going to be famous and rich. I'm going to travel all over the world." "Say it," Mary Margaret said.
Salome said nothing.
"I will never be anything like you. Say it. Say it."
"Your sister isn't strong," Mama always warned Salome, "and you mustn't upset your sister."
Salome helped Mary Margaret with her simple house chores. She bathed her and dressed her, and on Saturday morning she wrapped her hair in rags so she would have curls for Sunday Mass. Mama had lost both girls born before Mary Margaret, and Mary Margaret herself had almost died several times.
"Mary May is a gift from God," Mama liked to tell people. "God has spared her so many times, I am convinced He has saved her for a special purpose in this world."
"You will bleed between your legs just like me," Salome said. "You will have babies, and they'll hurt you there when they come from inside you." Mary Margaret reached across the space between their bodies. She pinched Salome's thigh as hard as she could, twisting the skin between her fingers.
"Take it back," she hissed, pinching and twisting. "Take it back."
But Salome would not. In the morning, Salome had a bruise that stretched down her thigh like a beautiful tapestry, swirls of magenta, alabaster, and carnadine. Her leg felt wooden when she walked. By the time the last trace of color had faded, it was late summer, August, the season of tornadoes. Mary Margaret never touched Salome after that.
Even today, she is careful when she hands Salome a curler, a bobby pin, so that their fingers do not accidentally meet. Salome takes special care of Mary Margaret's hair. She curls it, trims it, tints it the faintest shade of blue. Her fingers move by rote over the familiar landscape of her sister's scalp, wrapping each thin lock of hair into its own sweet nest. Her touch is brisk, certain, the touch of someone from whom there are no secrets, the touch of a confessor or even a lover, a mother's touch. Mama said Salome's dreams were the devil's mark, but Salome knew they came from God because her dreams always spoke the truth, and truth comes from heaven alone. She had just turned 13 when the dreams first came. On a sticky August night, she dreamed God's fingers reached down from the sky and walked across the land. Winds blew and trees fell. A hollow roar swelled from within the earth like the groan of an old and angry woman. Her brother Quinny shook her awake. "Tornado!" he shouted. "Get down to the cellar with the others. Don't you have a lick of sense?" Mary Margaret's side of the bed was empty, still faintly warm, musty sweet. "She could have woke me," Salome thought, "but she left me here to die." She lay motionless, feeling the weight of the hurt that swelled in her chest and stomach. She saw God's fingers whirling like dancers, picking her up lightly, carrying her away. "Come on!" Quinny screamed. "Wake up!" He shook Salome until she struggled out of the arms of the dream and followed him down into the cellar. The other boys were perched in a clump with Pa. Mary Margaret sat holding her little gray cat in Mama's lap, wrapped in a blanket, her beautiful hair like yellow paint in the light of the lantern. The cellar was square and small, with a packed dirt floor and crates stacked high for shelves. Three dead hens were strung from the low ceiling. Another had fallen, but no one moved to pick it up. Salome stepped over it carefully and crouched between the watermelons and the rough woven basket of eggs. "You could have woken me," she said to Mary Margaret. But Mary Margaret didn't open her eyes.
"She's just a little girl," Mama said. "She was frightened. She didn't know better."
"I could have gotten killed," Salome whispered.
"Hush." "You better put out that light," Pa said. And Mama snuffed their faces into darkness.
Then there was only the sound of the thunder and wind, the smell of damp earth, and the sauerkraut barrel. In the brilliant eye of her mind, Salome saw the window beside her bed burst into diamonds and knew that she would have died horribly had the Lord not chosen to spare her. She saw the dogs huddled under the porch, the sheep matted together into one wide card of wool, the whites of the horse's eyes. She saw the trees Paul had planted for a windbreak bend over neatly, a row of tottering children touching their toes.
"We'll be lucky to keep the roof," Mama said after a while.
"Our place will be fine," Salome said without thinking. "But all that's left of Ubinks is the cellar hole."
"The girl thinks she's a prophet," Mama said.
But in the morning, they found the Ubinks had been blown clean away. The only thing ever recovered was the butter churn, which had landed in the schoolyard. When the children opened it, a small bird flew out and disappeared into the trees. One of the cows gave birth to dead triplet calves, each of them white with blood-pink eyes. A flock of starlings descended on the currants. Too gut-swelled to fly, drunk on the fermenting juice, they skittered around the barnyard, frightening the horses, drowning in the water troughs. A distant cousin died, then a not-so-distant cousin. There were rumors of tuberculosis, and Mama thumped their chests and hung garlic wrapped in burlap around their necks. On the day the goats climbed the fence to get into the cabbage plot, Mama fixed her calculating gaze on Salome.
"What have you done that the devil finds you so interesting? You with your unholy dreams. All I need is my oldest gal running after some craziness in her head."
"There's nothing in my head, Ma," Salome said.
"I do believe that's true," Mama said grimly.
But Salome knew it was she who had been spared by the Lord for a purpose known only to him. One Sunday during Mass, she saw each station of the cross spring to life. She watched, horrified, as Christ was scourged, mounted upon a rough cross, thrust into the cradle of the sky. Tears came to her eyes, but as she looked around, She saw the rest of the congregation was unable to hear the lash of the whip, unable to smell the sour breath of Christ as he gasped for air. Children were playing with their hat clips, trying to snare flies with long pieces of hair. Fathers drooped in their seats, resting sharp chins on their chests. The faces of the mothers wore distant looks, and Salome felt with her mind how they were planning dinners, tallying crops, wondering where they had mislaid a thimble, a piece of calico, a letter. She burst into strangled sobs, hands clamped over her mouth. People exchanged knowing glances. Mama had had a sister who died young, convinced she could fly from the milk house roof, coaxed by angels no one else could see. "Es ist im Blut," they said. "It's in the blood." And they shook their heads as Mama led Salome from the church, weak and trembling, barely able to walk. In the wagon, Mama slapped Salome across the mouth. "You need to get some sense, young miss," she said. "You think you're some kind of saint, is that it? Tell me why God would send a vision to some dirty-minded gal. Sounds like it's the devil you got whispering in your ear." "It weren't me the devil wanted all them years," Salome says to Mama now. But there's no one to hear. She peers stiffly beneath her bed. She glances into the gaping black mouth of the closet. She looks out the bedroom door, down the hallway, into the kitchen. The apartment is empty. Salome is relieved. She snaps on the radio and listens to a strange man's voice speak of places she will never go, people she will never see. And she is comforted despite the smell of her flesh, the knot of hunger pulsing inside her like a child. At dawn, she wakes up, abruptly clear-headed. She fills the bathtub with water and scrubs the dried skin around her elbows and ankles and knees. She works ivory into her hair, rinses it clean, untangles the worst of the mat of curls at her neck with a stainless steel comb. Now she wants to fill her mouth with cheese and bread, soft ripe bananas, coffee rich with cream. But the brief spurt of energy has been washed away, and she bends over, coughing, coughing, a sound as hollow as a dog's angry bark. A tiredness enters her body, and she can't bring herself to put on her coat and step into the first sweet day of sunshine Holly's Field has had in weeks to walk downtown to buy food. In the kitchen, she eats Spanish olives from the jar, squirts the last of the ketchup into a spoon. She searches the cupboards for something she might have missed, knowing she ate the last preserves for supper, yellow beans, swallowing them cold from the jar. She rearranges the shortening can, the dark bottle of vanilla, the baking soda, and blackstrap molasses. Sunlight plays on the brittle geraniums lining the windowsill, and their leaves are patterned with maroon crescents which warn of their longing for sunlight, nutrients, warmth. At the bottom of the cookie jar, Salome finds the remainder of one of Ellen's gifts, the crumbling heels of a loaf of homemade bread, still soft inside a piece of plastic wrap. She toasts one, spreads it with shortening, keeping the other for later. Even her jaw feels heavy. She concentrates hard on chewing, pausing for breath between swallows. Several times a week, all through the month of January, Ellen came in the night to knock on Salome's door, startling her as she listened to the radio. "Go!" Salome hissed through the chain. "This is no time for you to be out." But always, Ellen coaxed her way inside, a kuchen or a jar of apple butter in her hands. She sat down on the couch as if she'd been invited and talked about uninteresting things. She gave Salome vitamin tablets for her cold, fresh, soft fruit, a pair of warm wool stockings. She seemed a nice enough girl, if lonely, but one night she began to pry. "What was your sister like when she was young? What do you remember most about your mother?" It was then that Salome realized she came not for company, but for information. "You'll learn nothing from me," Salome said. And she showed the girl and her cherry crisp to the door and locked it. She felt Ellen standing on the other side, craftily waiting for Salome to check if she was gone so she could slip back inside. In the morning, Salome found that cherry crisp beside the door, frozen solid in the pan. She left it there for one day, for two. Several nights later, Ellen's knock came at the door, but Salome got into bed and pulled the quilts up over her eyes. The next day, the cherry crisp was gone, and Ellen did not return with her questions. Now Salome can almost taste that cherry crisp, a tart bite of fruit smothered in sweet, sweet crust. Mama made cherry crisp each summer. Once, when Salome was a little girl and Mary Margaret just a baby, Pa stole a crisp off the porch where it was cooling. He gave a bite to each of the dogs, just enough to stain their muzzles guilty pink. Then he beckoned Salome and the boys into the barn, where they divided it, hot and sticky with their fingers, the barn cats stamping impatiently, sipping the air with their noses. When Salome opens her eyes, it is late afternoon. Her cheek is flat against the cool formica table. She has dreamed about two small children, toddling twin boys with lips and skin the pale blue of China. They babble silently, and though Salome searches their faces, she cannot understand what they are saying. One takes a bite from the other's cheek. The skin tears away easily. The cheekless one bites his brother's mouth, tugging his tongue out by the roots. Both children seem delighted as they consume each other's ears. "Stop!" Salome shrieks, but they bend to swallow each other's genitals, and Salome knows that there is no hope now. They are voracious, and after they are eaten up, there will be nothing left. It takes her a long time to hear the knock at the door, a series of thumps followed by laughter. The whirl of hunger in her stomach tightens. She pulls herself up and walks to the door through the bright dream of fever, marveling at the way the kitchen table and chairs, the countertop, the dying geraniums, and rubber garbage pail all look so small. She is a giant, each foot falling to the floor from a great distance, and when she gets to the door, it is a long reach down to find the knob. The twins are at the door. Salome recognizes them immediately, even though they are so much older and their cheeks and ears are whole and pink. Horror swallows her greeting, and she waits, staring at them, wondering what they want. They look at each other and giggle. Each carries a paper bag. One holds a box of cookies in his hand. They say together. Then one says, "You want to buy some cookies for the middle school marching band? We got chocolate mints and Savannahs." "And those cracker ones," the other boy says. "We got samples here if you want to try some, but it takes 6 weeks to get your order. We're trying to go to Canada, I mean, if we sell enough cookies by Easter. They're only $1.25. He holds out a box of cookies, and Salome can smell the sweetness through the garish cardboard wrapping. Surely they have come from beyond the grave, knowing so well how to torment her. "Come in," she says gruffly. If she doesn't let them see, she is afraid. Perhaps they'll go back where they came from, to that terrible world between God's kingdom and the sorrow of the pit. Undoubtedly, they wish to entice her there. They are lonely. They long for a woman's touch to soothe the burn of unconsecrated soil against their skin. The boys step inside, wrinkling their noses, and Salome can see Mary Margaret in their faces. The scornful high cheekbones, the slender beauty. Yellow hair, the color of paint. She tries not to imagine the taste of mint, the thick melt of chocolate on her tongue. "What do you want from me?" she begs them. "Honor thy father and mother, the good book says it. I had to do what Ma told me." The boys look at each other. It's just $1.25, one of them says. The other is looking past the dirty dishes in the kitchen to the cluttered living room, breathing through his mouth. "I never done nothing to either of you while you lived," Salome says. "I pray for your souls every day." The boys are watching their feet now, moving toward the door, but suddenly Salome cannot bear to see them go. She had chosen their granite stones from the wall below the barn, chipping them free with a pickaxe, and as she lifted those stones to the wheelbarrow, she'd felt a searing pain deep in her womb. This is the pain that burns her now as she remembers how she hauled those stones to the rise, overlooking the house where the earth was loose from rabbit burrows, where a shovel could puncture the cold clay crust and bury itself in soft peat. "I dug the graves," she cries out to them. "I freely admit that to you, but I did not help you die." One of the boys giggles, a high, nervous cackle, and in that sound, Salome hears the hollow wail of an infant. She smells the birthing room, sees Mary Margaret's flushed face, hears the clop of Fritz's heavy boots as he moved in and out of the doorway, smoking, letting the cold air in. "There ain't nothing wrong with you," he said. "Lots of gals drop babies without half the commotion you make." and Mama's face as she stared after him, hatred raw in the set of her lips. "Over my dead body," she said, "will he lay claim to either of these sweet children."
Salome starts to cry and reaches for the closest boy, but he wriggles out of her grip, dropping his bag of sample cookies.
"I never done you no harm," she begs.
But both boys duck past her and slip out the doorway, their sneakers squeaking on the icy steps. Salome stares after them, rubbing a pinch of her dress between her fingers.
"Not my will, but thine," she prays, imagining their long trip back to the netherworld.
And just as suddenly as they have disappeared, she understands they are messengers, and that once again, in his own way, the Lord who will not let a sparrow fall has provided for his own. She lifts the bag from the floor. It is filled with boxes of cookies, some opened, some sealed. Her hands shake as she selects a chocolate mint. She chews once and swallows, the shards scraping her throat, and then she is filling her mouth with chocolate mint cookies, peanut butter cookies, shortbreads, sesame crackers, white flour, sugar, egg. The pleasures of the body flood her soul, and she feels the first rush of energy run through her veins like new strong blood. That night, as she climbs into bed, she glances down the hallway into the kitchen to note the proud, sleek shine of the countertops, the chairs neatly fencing the table, the swept floor. Tucked in the refrigerator, safe from mice, are three boxes of cookies for tomorrow, the day after that. By then, her legs will be steady again. She'll walk to the bank, cash her Social Security, fill her cupboards with all the food she can carry. She falls asleep with her full stomach rising and falling under her hand as light spills across her face from the round, high moon that wavers above the water treatment plant. Mary Margaret feels the changes deep inside her body. At first, she does not understand. Morning, she is dizzy and nauseated. She creeps to the kitchen, one hand trailing along the wall for balance, and sips at the tea Ellen makes for her, not speaking, afraid she might vomit or weep. Her ankles are swollen, grotesque, and though she tries to keep them hidden beneath the hem of her robe, that gal won't leave her alone. "You want me to fix you some Epsom salts?" she asks. "You think you should see a doctor?" But Mary Margaret waves her away. She's short of breath. She cannot think. She sits at the piano for hours, hands draped loosely over the keys. At night, she lies awake, watching the pale green limbs of the clock beside the bed. There's something familiar about the way she feels, but the memory teases her, swimming the edge of her consciousness, just out of reach like a half-forgotten song. Then, one afternoon, as she lies down for her nap, she feels tiny hands grip the ladder of her ribs. The babies have grown back inside her. They clamp their mouths tight against her lungs, nursing air, kneading at the tender tissue with their fists. Mary Margaret pounds her chest and sides, her soft, flat belly, but she cannot shake them loose. She tries hot baths and enemas. She clips a novena from the weekly paper. "Thank you, St. Jude, for favors granted. Pray to St. Jude for all your needs for 9 consecutive days. Say 3 Our Fathers, 3 Hail Marys, and 3 Glorias." But as the days pass, the babies only grow bolder, kicking their feet when she speaks the holy words, climbing up and up until they lick at her heart with half-formed tongues. She remembers how they were born so small, wrinkled as lambs and squalling. She hadn't wanted any more children. She had had enough with the nausea, the swelling of her feet, the bite of the slimming corset she wore so the vulgar push of her belly wouldn't show. She had had enough with Fritz's rough hands. After James was born in 36, she spent 6 months in bed, sick with what the doctor called milk poison, but what she knew was a sickness of the soul. Soon after that, she made up her mind to go against God and nature. "You be grateful for what you got," she told Fritz the day she got back to her feet. "You won't get anything more out of me. Go into town to fill your needs. Go to the barn with the pigs for all I care."
For the next year, she was strong as Mama, strong as Salome, strong as the women she met in church who looked their husbands in the eye and never carried an arm in a sling or favored a fresh crushed foot. She slept in the boys' room with a thick oak door bolted shut. During the day, she carried a knife. Each day she worked hard, digging bushels of potatoes and onions from the garden, splitting her own kindling at dusk, and as the months passed, the residue Fritz's body had left on her washed away like soft lard soap. She slept deeply at night, her little sons draped warm as cats against her sides, with no rough hand to pinch her throat, no thick wedge of flesh rasping away inside her. Fritz eyed her at the supper table.
"I got me 40 acres. You know two sons ain't enough for all that."
Once he brushed his hip against hers, but he stepped out of reach of the quick wink of steel, and then Mama stood behind him with a chunk of stove wood.
"I told you not to interfere," he said to Mama. "Remember how I warned you."
He surprised Mary Margaret one cold, bright January day as she lifted her skirts in the back house. She did not have time to think. He hit her once in the forehead with a brick and pulled her out into the snow. Blood ran into her eyes as she ran blindly, her only thought to move, to keep moving until the brick found the back of her head. Then she lay still as he emptied himself inside her. And when he finished, he pissed yellow circles around her body. The warmth of his urine melted the snow and stung against her face. She prayed for a miracle, even as his seed took hold. But she had been the one to defy God's will, to refuse the marriage bed and the new souls it might bring. "Not my will, but thine be done," Christ cried out to God from the agony of the cross. And Mary Margaret understood that it had not been a prayer but a torn white flag. Whatever God wanted, he would take as his due. If Christ could not resist, how could she? When Mama found out what had happened, she made a special secret tea to shake the seed from Mary Margaret's womb. But though she held the cup to Mary Margaret's lips, Mary Margaret refused to drink from it. She knew now that God would have his way, if not through this child, then another. But perhaps, if she became small enough, God might start to overlook her. Perhaps if she kept his commandments, lived by his rules, he wouldn't take notice of her ever again. Surely the heaven that followed this life would make up for whatever she'd suffered. And so she knocked the cup from Mama's hands and prepared for another birth.
"Willow," Mama said, "you may bend, but you won't break."
But Mary Margaret knew that she was broken, her limbs clipped and bound for kindling, her trunk chopped off at the knees. This pregnancy was worse than the others. Morning, she lay helplessly in bed, waiting for Mama's strong arms to lift her out of the sheets, still damp with Fritz's smell, to hold the basin while she vomited, to slap her feet until she had enough feeling to lower them to the ground. Then she braced herself against the wall as Mama tightened the stays of the slimming corset that hid her shame from the eyes of the neighbors, the children, the parishioners, the priest. After that, it was all Mary Margaret could do to walk downstairs and help get breakfast for the hungry little boys. By the 8th month, Mama had to slip the corset so Mary Margaret could breathe. One day, Mama even suggested she go downstairs indecent. "He never looks at you," she said. "You be sitting at the table, he might not even notice." But Fritz did notice, and in front of the boys, he told her how she disgusted him.
"You go on back upstairs," he said. "And don't come down till you look like a Christian, not some heathen gal with your business hanging out."
"To him, we're no more than animals," Mama said, as she laced Mary Margaret back into the corset. "But I'm going to fix it so he knows we are worse. He won't want nothing to do with you after that."
"He will never leave me alone," Mary Margaret said.
When her time drew near, Fritz went to Milwaukee to fetch Salome, who moved through the house like a shadow, frightening the little boys with her strange and silent ways. Mary Margaret sat in the kitchen, sipping shepherd's purse tea to help bring on the labor, and hating her sister for her simple, silent body. Salome had never been sullied by a man's coarse touch. Salome's belly had never filled up with blood and guts that turned themselves into a child. Salome, like the saints, was a virgin, pure, and she would sing with the angels someday, her small plain mouth opening wide to release a music that Mary Margaret could only dream of hearing. "Mary May is a gift from God," Mama had said when Mary Margaret was a little girl. But Mary Margaret knew now she was no gift to anyone. Slow and obese, breaking wind, chained to the earth by the cruel will of God while Salome rose before her eyes. It was a cold fall day when she went into labor. The night before there had been a mild frost, but the ground still squished beneath her boots as she dragged herself to the house from the back house, warm water flooding her thighs. Inside, Fritz sat on the good parlor couch, rubbing tallow into his boots. The little boys sucked on their fingers as Mary Margaret followed Mama up the stairs to the bedroom, and the eyes of the older boy went curious and wide. Throughout the birth, she screamed with rage, but eventually her voice weakened, faded, then dried up altogether. She could do no more than hiss by the time Mama pulled the baby's bodies from her own, their wet skin steaming in the chill. Their cries brought Fritz, who stood in the doorway as Mama and Salome scrambled to cover Mary Margaret properly.
"Don't wait up on me, sweetheart," he leered. "I'm going out to celebrate my two new sons."
Mary Margaret closed her eyes. Beyond all doubt, she wanted to be dead, but she did not die. And in the morning when she woke, the cradle beside the bed stood empty. "Where are they?" she asked Salome, who was sitting at the foot of the bed. "I want to touch my babies before he does." But Salome dropped her head into her hands. "There are no babies," she said, and she was shaking. "You better talk to Ma about all that." "Where are they?" Mary Margaret said again, but Salome was yelling. "She's awake!" When Mama came into the room, she held Mary Margaret's face between her hands. "He had no right to those children," she said, "after all he'd done to you." Still, Mary Margaret did not understand. "Look at how he is with Mitch and Jimmy," Mama said. "What I done for these babies as well as for you." And she helped Mary Margaret to her feet, neatly made up the bed, opened the windows to air out the room, and took the bloody linens to the barrel to be burned. When Fritz came home, bleary-eyed with beer, they were sitting in the kitchen as if it were any ordinary day. Mama, Mary Margaret, and Salome, the boys wearing bibs and eating scrambled eggs.
"What, you up already?"
he said. But Mama just shook her head. What did he mean? They were eating breakfast. It did not take long for him to discover the two small graves on the hillside overlooking the house. But Mama laughed at him and said they were dogs' graves. God knew he'd killed enough of them over the years.
"What babies?"
Mama said, and she laughed at him for weeks.
"So drunk you can't remember how many boys you got? Any more boys you think you got coming, they'll be in your imagination, too. Crazy old man. The next thing you know, we'll be calling up the neighbors to put you away."
For years, Mary Margaret would catch him looking at her in the horrified way she had once looked at him, as if she were a piece of rotted meat, rancid and foul, and a deep satisfaction warmed her because she knew that he was afraid.
"She-devil," he'd said to her, "just to hear your voice makes my skin crawl."
It made up for the nights she lay awake, trying to remember those newborn faces, weeping for those starfish hands. It almost made up for the anguish she felt after Mama died, when she dreamed of Mama writhing in eternal fire and heard her voice as clearly as if she were still living. "What I done for you." But the will of God is more powerful than women. On the ninth day of the novena, Mary Margaret begins to weep, for once again her prayers have been ignored. She doesn't go with Fritz to senior citizens anymore. She doesn't linger after Sunday Mass to shake Father Bork's smooth hand. She doesn't call Salome to come over and curl her hair. She is a tree, axed and bound for kindling, submitting her life to God's will the way Mama would not. Now she spends the days sitting quietly on the couch, watching Let's Make a Deal, The Dating Game, Jeopardy. Outside her window, it is finally spring, but Mary Margaret doesn't notice. In her mind, it is a cold, bright January day, the snow stinging her forehead and chin.
She feels the great weight on her back, hears the sharp grunts in her ear. Over and over, she prays the prayer she whispered as a new bride. Lord, help me to accept what I cannot change. Until the beginning of it and the end of it run into each other, the way you cannot tell when one breath ends and the next begins.
Money. Swimming lessons begin in June. Ellen enrolls Amy and Herbert in spite of James's complaints about the cost.
If we're going to live near a lake, she tells him, they have to know how to swim.
James, she knows, is afraid of water, afraid of the sound it makes as it enters your ears, engulfing you, pinning you down until you work with the feeling of it rather than against it when it buoys you up like a gentle hand. Amy is afraid of water, too. Since she stepped on a dog skeleton in Autumn Lake, she will not place her feet where she cannot see them.
What were you thinking of? James still says angrily, letting the children into that dirty water.
But Holly's field pool is chemical clean, dyed the appropriate shade of blue. Lifeguards prowl the edges. The temperature is kept at an even 78 degrees. There are no dead leaves or fish, no sharp rocks that might cut a child's heel, no skeletons or sunken beer cans filled with mud. Even James agrees it's perfectly safe, but he says, money, money, we don't have that kind of money. Until, on their wedding anniversary, Ellen takes the checkbook from his briefcase, goes downtown, and pays the non-refundable registration fee. For the past 10 months, James has banked all her paychecks and usually some of his, too. But the more money they accumulate, the more James panics at the thought of spending any of it. Ellen studies him with an oddly clinical interest as he dresses in old shirts with yellow, frayed collars, drives 3 blocks out of his way so he won't have to put a quarter in a parking meter, pockets occasional loose change from the muddy church parking lot on Sundays. At night, he talks about the future, dreams that money will buy for them all. Amy will be a pediatrician. Herbert will practice law. He paces the room in his boxer shorts and T-shirt, talking about the situation in Vietnam, the economy, the nation, the TV humming behind him like a chorus. Ellen lies in bed, not speaking, for it is not a response James wants, and waits for the warm wash of sleep, the aftertaste of the pills she swallowed still bitter against her tongue. With this new prescription, she has enough pills so she doesn't have to ration. She keeps most of them in the bathroom, hidden in the body of Mary Margaret's empty ballerina, safe from James and the kids. The rest she carries in her purse. It's hard to think about cutting back, even though she knows she's been taking too many. But she hasn't had insomnia like this since after her father died. Then sleep had brought nightmares of long, tangled mazes. Men were coming for Daddy, and Ellen struggled to hide him in the pantry, in the root cellar, high up in the silver dome of the silo. Often he was so small he fit neatly into the palm of her hand. Once she even hid him in her mouth, but the men always found him, always carried him away through a series of twisted paths which Ellen could not follow. Now, each night she pokes her fingers into the ballerina's belly, and in the morning she wakes up in the position in which she fell asleep, sometimes with her hand numb beneath her pillow. She sleeps fiercely, dreading the buzz of the alarm, the flash of sunlight beneath the drapes. Just 5 more minutes, she pleads with the children when they tap on the bedroom door. The aqua lady of her childhood would certainly not behave this way. The aqua lady would be up at dawn to make homemade muffins for her family. She'd wear sweet gingham aprons and aqua hose, high heels to show off her legs. Mornings, Ellen pulls on the same shorts and T-shirt she wears each day, stares into the mirror at the plum-colored welts beneath her eyes, trying to find something in her face that is familiar. "I can't believe you did that," James sputtered when she dropped the pool receipt into his lap, muttering, "Happy anniversary," under her breath. He and Fritz were playing cards, their faces the same in the half-light, until James tipped his chin forward, embarrassed in front of his father. "You listen to me," he said firmly, grabbing her arm. "Good night," Ellen said, twisting free, and she went down the hall to the bedroom without saying anything more.
She was half undressed when James came in and shut the door behind him.
"What's wrong with you?" he said.
"You just aren't yourself anymore." She unhooked her bra, and he looked away uncomfortably. His gaze traced the fine cracks in the ceiling plaster, stroked the tops of the window frames. But she did not put on her nightgown. She did not cover her breasts with her hands. Goosebumps rose on her arms. She realized how thin she was, how much weight she had lost over the past few months, and she laughed a little because it was so ironic. She didn't even bother to diet anymore. Her body was angular, knobbed with bone. Her breasts sagged against her ribs.
"Are you laughing at me?" James said. "Why are you laughing at me? You're the one standing there naked. You're the one not making any sense."
His voice was high, uncertain. When she didn't answer, he said, "Put some clothes on, you'll catch cold." He still did not look at her. "Do I embarrass you?" Ellen said, moving into his line of vision. "Does this embarrass you?" She touched her breasts, and his face grew sharp with disgust. She couldn't imagine ever loving him, wanting him, his damp, nervous body locked against her own. What she wanted now was to frighten him with her own flesh, with what he had rejected, to make him feel ashamed the way he made her feel ashamed. James flinched. "You shouldn't talk that way," he said, "as if you're crazy."
"You're the one who's crazy. You're the one who won't even spend the money for our kids to learn how to swim. I just want what's best for everyone.
You want what's best for you. How much money is enough, James? How much before it will make you safe? You had no right to go behind my back.
Let me tell you something. You will never be safe.
All the money in the world, and you'll still be the same person you are now, still under your father's thumb."
"In my family, we learned how to save money," James said shrilly. "In my family, we didn't waste money on every little thing we wanted."
Ellen sat down on the bed.
"Go away now," she said quietly, "because if you don't, I'm going to break every last thing in this room. And when your father comes running to see what's wrong, I'll dance naked on what's left of the furniture."
She slipped the nightgown over her head so she wouldn't have to see the sickly look on James's face. By the time she pulled the nightgown down, he was gone. The door closed gently behind him. Covering her face with her hands, she tried to feel remorse, but she was distracted by the darkness of her palms and the way light filtered red between the edges of her fingers. She knew that to anyone watching, she would appear stricken with grief. But Ellen didn't feel anything. After a while, she gave up trying. She spread her fingers, closed them, idly watching the dresser, the statue of the Virgin, the crucifix